This episode contains the topics of sexual assault, rape, and murder of children and young women. Listener discretion is advised. If you have any information regarding the Freeway Phantom murders, please call Prince George's County Crime Solvers at 866-411-TIPS. That's 866-411-8477. Welcome to Momicide Podcast. I'm Amanda.
And I'm Kristen.
In today's episode, I will be telling Kristen the story of the Freeway Phantom. This case took place in Washington, D.C. In Washington in the late 1960s to early 70s, it was a time before advanced DNA testing. Roughly two-thirds of the city's residents were Black, and there was a widespread distrust of the police force, which at the time was approximately 80% white. It had been only a few years since the 1968 riots after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., and with heightened racism and racial tensions and inequalities, political divide, the Vietnam War, and the Watergate scandal, Washington, D.C. was anything but tranquil. Almost simultaneously, a man dubbed the Freeway Phantom by the media would soon be realized as D.C.'s first serial killer. He was just beginning a killing spree that lasted over a year and a half and would take the lives of at least six young African-American girls, some just blocks away from their family homes. Over the years, despite the fact that this case has been investigated by numerous detectives and jurisdictions, the Freeway Phantom has remained just that, a phantom. Today, 50 years later, with no witnesses or viable leads, his identity remains a mystery, leaving communities and families without answers or closure. Before we start, I don't think we have any pressing issues or commentary to add, but we just wanted to thank you for your patience as we battled the back-to-daycare viruses and illnesses. Mm-hmm. We had some croup, some stomach flu.
Oh, God.
You name it.
Yeah.
We're doing good now, so all is well over here. And we just also wanted to say a quick thank you if you are a new listener. Thanks so much for listening, and welcome. In Washington, D.C., in April of 1971, 13-year-old Carol Spinks was just a couple of months away from finishing the seventh grade. Carol lived with her mother and seven siblings. Carol's mom was a single mother. Carol also had an identical twin sister named Carolyn, and the pair were extremely close. Carol's sister said that they did so many things together, it was almost like they were one. Carol was very quiet, sweet, and timid. She had a small frame, she was roughly 4 feet tall, and her family called her Bebe. On Sunday, April 25th, Carol's mother, Alan Teen, left to visit a relative in Maryland, while Carol and her siblings stayed in the family's apartment. The Spinks family rule was that if their mother was not home, they were not to leave the house nor open the door for anyone. Shortly after Alan Teen left the home, the Spinks children heard a knock on the door and realized that it was their oldest sister, 24-year-old Valerie, who didn't live at home anymore, but happened to be in the building at the time visiting a friend. She asked one of her younger siblings to go to the store for her, and despite them insisting that they weren't allowed to leave, Valerie persisted, banging and knocking on the door, until finally Carol gave in and told her siblings that she would run to the store for their older sister. As Carol Spinks heads down the road towards 7-Eleven, she runs into her mother, who scolds her for leaving the apartment when she was specifically told not to. Alan Teen tells Carol that they will talk about it when she gets home, and then watches her daughter enter the corner store. Approximately 30 minutes after Carol left, her younger sister became worried, went next door, and asked their older sister Valerie where Carol was, but Valerie had also not realized that Carol didn't return home yet. So she ran to the store and was told by the clerk that Carol had been there, but she had already left. The 7-Eleven was about a half a mile or less than a kilometer away from the Spinks' apartment building. She returned home quickly and realized that Carol was still not home. Finally, Alantine arrived home, and upon learning that her daughter hadn't arrived home as well, she called the police to report Carol missing. Unfortunately, Carol's mother was told by police that her daughter had likely just run away. Carol's family knew something was wrong, and her mother organized a search team made up of family, friends, and neighbors. They searched for hours, but they weren't able to find Carol. 6 days after Carol Spinks went missing, the police discovered her lifeless body behind St. Elizabeth's Hospital, next to the northbound lanes of the I-295. Carol was found fully clothed, but her shoes were missing. Her body was covered in wounds, there were cuts and bruises on her face and hands, as well as a visible contusion around her throat. It was found that she had been sodomized and strangled. Additionally, there was undigested food found in Carol's stomach, which indicated that, since she had gone missing 6 days prior, she had been held captive and fed by her captor during the period she was missing. Investigators with the DC Metro Police began searching the neighborhood for clues as to who had abducted, sexually assaulted, and killed 13-year-old Carol Spinks. 28-year-old Detective Romaine Jenkins with the Homicide Unit, who was the first female detective in her unit in Washington, D.C., and she was actually also the first Black female detective, was initially put on the case to interview neighbors and relatives. So I'm going to show you a picture of Carol as well as the detective. So here's Carol.
And she was the 13-year-old one, right?
She's 13, yep.
She's so cute.
She's really cute. I find she looks a little younger than 13.
Yeah, she does in that picture.
And then we have the detective. So here is a picture of her when she was a teenager. And then here is a current picture of the detective. So like I said before, at the time, the police force was made up of about 80% white people.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a really huge thing for her to come in as not only a woman, but a Black woman.
Mm.
And she was essentially put on the unit to sort of look after essentially child deaths and abortions.
Okay. And she was assigned to this case?
Right. It was almost immediately after she was in the homicide unit that this happened.
I can't imagine the pressure she would feel being a Black woman in a predominantly white police force.
And especially it was also probably predominantly male.
Right. And then so she's obviously feels the need to prove herself. But then to be assigned this case where it's like a Black child is now murdered. Mm-hmm. And just by the title, I'm assuming that there's more.
Yep, there is.
Yeah. So if I were her, I would feel this immense pressure to solve this case, because mm-hmm. you would feel like it's one of your own and it's a child at the same time.
Yeah, and she totally did, and we'll get into that later.
Mm-hmm.
So like I said before, she was initially put on the case to interview neighbors and relatives. A witness claimed that she saw Carol walking with a friend and said she saw Carol being grabbed off the street by two Black men in a blue car. This quote friend that was allegedly with Carol at the time was interviewed by police and claimed to not have seen Carol's abduction, but she did say that she walked with her for a short period of time. She also indicated that following that evening, she began receiving phone calls wherein a person on the other line would tell her that she would be next. Detectives also found that a woman and her daughter witnessed Carol walking home from the 7-Eleven carrying a bag. So with this piece of information, police were able to determine that Carol was abducted very close to her home.
So this friend that was with her,
mm-hmm.
was she the one who initially said that she saw two Black men?
It was somebody else. So somebody saw Carol with her friend.
Oh, okay.
And said that the two Black men grabbed her off the street.
Gotcha.
And the friend said, I was there with her, but I left and I didn't see any abduction.
Okay.
So two different people. Then in May of 1971, as investigators searched for leads in the case, various Vietnam War protests were held in Washington, D.C. Thousands of people had protests and rallies across the Capitol, attempting to block traffic and the routes of government officials to stop them from getting to their offices and places of work. This led to an abundance of arrests, so many that they were running out of room in the prisons. So police set up makeshift camps around Washington to hold protesters, and the state of chaos led to all of the officers in the district, even the homicide squad, including Detective Jenkins, being called in for emergency duty and placed on prisoner alert. Romaine Jenkins said, quote, "If you wanted to be a criminal, this was the time to do it. because all of the police were pretty much tied up, end quote. So I'm going to show you a photo, and this was the day that Carol's body was found. So these are the protests that were happening. So lots and lots of people, and it required a lot of police.
They were protesting the Vietnam War?
Right. It made sense. Essentially, it was, you know, we want peace, peace in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But with that many people and outside the White House, the police had to essentially send all units there.
Right, yeah.
So due to the protests, the investigation of Carol's murderer fell to the wayside. Carol's family remembers rarely seeing the police questioning residents, looking into leads, or searching for Carol's killer. And this made them extremely angry and worried about if or when the killer may strike again. Until he did. Just over 2 months after Carol Spink's abduction, another girl who lived in the same neighborhood went missing. 16-year-old Darlenia Johnson. So here's a photo of Darlenia. On the morning of July 8, 1971, Darlenia left her home to go to work at a local rec center where she would be staying the night, but she never showed up. Upon realizing that Darlenia was missing, her mother filed a missing persons report. As the weeks passed with no leads or updates on her whereabouts, Darlenia's mother, Helen, received a string of alarming phone calls. The phone would ring, she would pick up, but only hear heavy breathing on the other end of the call. Helen thought that perhaps Darlenia was calling, but was afraid to speak. One day, Helen received a final phone call, and this time there was a man on the other end of the call who said, quote, "I killed your daughter," end quote, and promptly hung up.
Can you imagine?
No, I would be absolutely sick.
I'd be completely beside myself.
Helen immediately called the police. There obviously wasn't caller ID, let alone the ability to trace a phone call. Just 4 days after Darlenia had gone missing, a D.C. Department of Highways and Traffic employee was having issues with his car and pulled over on the side of the I-295. Upon exiting his vehicle, he noticed the body of a young black female lying face down in the grass. He called in to report this, and it had surprisingly been the second time it had been reported that same day. However, the officers who drove to the area did not stop and get out of the vehicle and reported that there was no body. One entire week later, one of the previous two callers drove by the area again to find that same body in the exact same spot they had previously reported to police. Another phone call was made, and finally, on July 19th, 1971, 11 days after Darlenia had gone missing, an officer discovered Darlenia Johnson's decomposing body on the side of the I-295. So she had been found a week earlier. They went and didn't investigate, said there was nothing, and all that time passed, and finally somebody went and looked and found her body.
So was she, like, hidden? Was she hard to find? Like, why didn't they find her the first time?
They just didn't get out of the car. That's why they didn't find her. The body was out in the open, laying in the grass.
I have nothing to say about that.
An important note here is that while Darlenia was clothed, her shoes, which were brown loafers, were also missing. Upon performing an autopsy, the medical examiner concluded that the body had been sitting in the sun decomposing for approximately 2 weeks. Due to the fact that the body had substantially decomposed, it was not possible to identify the young girl through the recognition of facial and physical features. So investigators scoured through missing persons reports and were ultimately able to use the clothing worn by the victim to help determine that it was the body of Darlenia Johnson. A manner nor a cause of death were able to be determined due to the state of decomposition when her body was found. Do you know the difference between manner and cause?
In what context?
Legal context. I'm going to explain it if you don't.
The manner of there's death manner, versus cause of death?
Yeah, there's manner of death and then there's cause of death.
I thought they were the same thing.
So did I. So I'm going to quickly explain the difference. So the cause of death describes the injury or condition which led to the individual's death, such as strangulation or gunshot wound to the head. And the manner of death is the determination of how the injury or condition led to death, such as natural, homicide, accident, undetermined. Oh. So manner of death would be homicide.
Yeah, a more broad statement.
Cause of death would be strangulation or whatever.
Gotcha.
So manner is like the circumstances, and the cause would be the event that caused them to die.
Yeah. also, I find it so crazy because for us growing up and having, you know, murders happen and be solved, it's usually done with DNA.
Right.
So thinking back to these years, what was this, the late 60s, early 70s?
It was early 70s, yeah.
Where like DNA wasn't a thing. It's crazy to think that they couldn't just confirm who it was that easily with DNA.
Exactly.
They basically, it's just like a guessing game, like what they had to use her clothing. Like, yep. That seems like such a wishy-washy way to confirm somebody's identity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, there were so many murders and serial killers and stuff like that back in that time that went unsolved because they were able to get away with it.
Mm-hmm. Because they could just be careless and they didn't have to worry about their sperm or their hair or whatever, right?
Yeah, so it's crazy.
Despite the fact that neither the cause nor manner of death could be determined, investigators strongly believe that Darlenia's manner of death was homicide, obviously. This is because she was found at the exact same location that Carol Spink's body was found, only 15 feet from one another.
Really?
So this was behind the same hospital. So this is behind St. Elizabeth's Hospital.
And why are their shoes missing?
I don't know. We'll talk about that later, too.
Okay.
Additionally, shortly after Darlenia was reported missing, a witness reported having seen her in an old black car driven by an African-American male. It was also initially thought that Darlenia's boyfriend might have been responsible because another witness claimed to have seen her with him. However, he insisted that he was not with her that day and had nothing to do with her murder. At this point in the investigation, the police believed that there was more than one perpetrator abducting and killing young black females. So there was no connection between the deaths yet, even though they were 15 feet apart.
Okay, that seems a little ridiculous, mm-hmm. but
I think it probably didn't help that Darlenia's body was so badly decomposed they couldn't tell if she was also strangled.
Right.
Inconsistencies or whatever, but mm-hmm.
But how often do two young black girls just end up dead on the side of the road, like feet apart from each other?
Exactly.
And you don't try to connect those cases.
Mm-hmm. Around this time, community members in the area held a press conference to highlight the quote, poor police protection and failure to apprehend the murderers, end quote. Within the press conference, Calvin Rolark, an editor for the Washington Informer, called out police for their lack of attention to crimes in the area of Southeast DC. He said, quote, if it was a blue-eyed white girl from Silver Springs, her picture would have been all over page one. We are demanding from the police the same kind of services you get in Georgetown. Now it takes 3 or 4 and sometimes 6 hours before police respond. If they won't protect us, we'll have to protect ourselves by forming vigilantes, end quote. Men in the area were told to carry rocks to throw at any suspicious vehicles or people loitering in the neighborhoods. At this time, police didn't believe there was any evidence linking the two murders, like I said before, and police presence was not increased. It was indicated by police that crime rates in the area were not out of the ordinary. Only 8 short days later, another young girl goes missing, this time on the other side of the city, 10-year-old Brenda Crockett. 10 years old.
Unreal.
So here's a picture of Brenda.
She just looks like a little girl.
So innocent.
Because that's
sweet.
What she is, a little girl.
Yep.
That's devastating.
On the evening of July 27th, 1971, Brenda, who was said to be a polite and kind young girl, spent the day splashing in the fire hydrant, then watched a movie in her community. Upon returning home that evening, Brenda's mother sends Brenda to the grocery store to pick up a few items. The grocery store was only roughly a block and a half away. However, after an hour passed with no sign of Brenda, her mother went out to look for her. As she searched, her home phone rang. Brenda's younger sister, Bertha, answered the phone. On the other end of the line was Brenda, and she told her sister, quote, a white man picked me up, and I'm heading home in a cab, end quote. Bertha was only 7 years old at the time, so she didn't fully understand what was going on. Brenda then abruptly said, quote, bye, and the call ended. But after a few minutes passed, she called back. This time, Brenda's stepfather answered the phone. Bertha heard him frantically asking Brenda where she was, telling her that he would come pick her up, to which Brenda responded that she was in Virginia. Brenda asked her stepfather, quote, "Did my mom see me?" End quote. And he told her, quote, "If your mom saw you, she would have gotten you," end quote. She also indicated that she was alone in a house with a white male. Her stepfather asked her to tell the man to come to the phone, and as he said this, he could hear heavy footsteps in the background just before Brenda said, quote, "I'll see you," and hung up. Brenda was crying as the call ended.
So whoever is doing this is clearly taunting the families, because this is now the third family that he's called them.
Mm-hmm.
And he's getting just more brave. Like, now you're calling with their child on the other line or on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Or doing the heavy breathing in the background and just this fucking creepy shit.
It's so fucked up.
Like, it's horrible enough to do that, to like kidnap somebody's kid and kill them and just chuck them on the side of the road. But to sit there and taunt them with phone calls before and after the fact is so twisted. I just have no words.
Oh my gosh, it's horrifying. Brenda's mother returned home, worried that she wasn't able to locate her daughter, and was informed of the bizarre phone calls. She immediately contacted police, and they showed up at the Crockett residence to interview the family. That's when Brenda was reported missing. The following morning, July 28, 1971, Brenda's body was found by a hitchhiker walking along Route 50 in Prince George's County, Maryland. She was found on the side of the road, lying on her back with a scarf tied tightly around her neck. It was determined that Brenda had been strangled and sexually assaulted. Her shoes were also missing, however, it's alleged that she may have been barefoot when she was abducted. It was noted, though, that her feet were unusually clean, which led investigators to believe that the perpetrator may have washed them. Several of the curlers that she was wearing when she was abducted were also missing. This murder is then investigated by detectives in Prince George's County, and police specifically dig deeper into the bizarre phone calls received by Brenda's family, looking for clues or evidence to help them find the perpetrator. Firstly, Detective Romaine Jenkins believed that the call was completely scripted by Brenda's abductor. Brenda's question, quote, "Did my mother see me?" end quote, led Jenkins to believe that the perpetrator was worried that her mother had seen her abduction. Jenkins said, quote, "Why would you let her call home not once but twice? He had to make sure that the mother didn't see her," end quote. Investigators also believed that the information provided by Brenda during the phone call was intended to throw off the investigation or lead police in the opposite direction. Therefore, it was presumed that the man was likely not white and was not in Virginia. Again, police were unable to determine the source or location of the phone calls. So they essentially thought he would say, okay, I'll bamboozle them and get her to tell them the opposite of what's happening to try and trick them.
Mm-hmm.
But investigators right off the bat were like, this is probably not true information, since he was clearly in the background.
Yeah.
And he was just telling her what to say.
Right.
At this point, three young girls had been abducted and murdered. The media presence was increasing in surrounding areas as they did their own investigating. Young black girls in the area were terrified that they would be the unknown man's next victim. Although the specific term serial killer didn't exist yet at the time, investigators had begun to connect the murders. It was also clear at this point that the killer was escalating, because the time between the victims going missing and being murdered, as well as between victims, was getting shorter and shorter. So the first was 2 months, and then between the second and the third was just over a week later.
How can you be ready to kill somebody again that fast? I would think that it would take some time for the dust to settle and shit to cool down before you just get full of rage and want to like kill somebody again. But apparently it's not the case for everybody.
No. Then, on October 1st, 1971, roughly 2 months after the third victim's body was found, another girl was abducted in Northeast Washington in the middle of the day. 12-year-old Nina Moshe Yates, who was known as Nino to her friends and family. So here's a picture of Nina Moshe.
They all look so young.
And they're just so sweet, and you can just see the innocence in their eyes.
Yeah, so sad.
Nina Moshe liked to bike and roller skate, loved school, and was said to be notably polite. She was also sent to the store by her father to run an errand, and it was a Safeway store that was found just one block away from her residence. Around 7 p.m., Nina Moshe headed out. She made it to the store, purchased the items, and was seen leaving the Safeway holding a shopping bag, but she didn't make it back home. Only 2 hours later, just off the shoulder of Route 4, just inside Prince George's County, Nina Moshe's lifeless body is found. Although it had been raining that evening, the grass under her body was still dry and her body was still warm, which indicated that she hadn't been there for long. Only 40 minutes had passed since Nina was last seen leaving the Safeway and when her body was found. It was determined that she had been strangled and sexually assaulted. She was wearing white tennis shoes, but a brown loafer was found next to her body, so it's thought that this could have potentially been one of Darlenia's that were missing.
So he's just trying to leave clues now.
Yeah, either that or something that I thought was that he was just careless and thought, oh, this is in my car, I'm just going to throw it with the body too.
Hmm.
The shoe thing is a mystery.
It's very odd.
It was clear that she had been redressed by someone else, as she had been wearing a sanitary napkin or a pad and it was improperly placed back into her underwear. A witness allegedly reported seeing Nina Moshe getting into a blue Volkswagen, and although this tip was investigated by police, it led nowhere. Furthermore, a tire track was found near her body, and although an imprint was taken, it didn't prove to be helpful in the investigation. Detectives found the bag that Nina Moshe had once carried, abandoned on the sidewalk in her neighborhood, so investigators concluded that she must have been forced into the car and did not get into the car willingly. 4 murders, no witnesses, and absolutely no viable leads in this case. Members of surrounding areas were furious, with most residents believing that there had to be a connection between all of the murders, feeling fearful of the future and wanting answers. The media continued to cover the murders, which put pressure on the police. The killer was then referred to as the Freeway Phantom within news articles. This name was given because the media believed that the perpetrator would drive the I-295 beltway, stalk his victims, abduct them, and flee. Although investigators made the connection, they were not yet certain if the 4 murders were connected. However, with the help of the FBI, the cases would begin to be investigated together.
So, how close were the 4 bodies together? I know you said the first 2 were super close, but then...
Yeah, I can show you a map. So, this map has all 6 murders on it, but I can just show you an idea of how close they were.
Okay. Kind of spread apart, but nothing too crazy. They're all sort of within the same, you can tell it's off the same highway.
Yeah, so essentially there's this beltway, this I-295 beltway in the middle, and where the bodies were dumped, you have access to these areas driving that road.
Gotcha.
The FBI's initial role involved mainly forensic investigation because the laboratories in the local police departments were not as extensive. The culminated evidence from the crime scenes was meticulously re-examined. It was determined, again, that all 4 of the victims had been strangled, so this was new information. They were able to determine that the second victim, despite how decomposed her body was, she was strangled, and 3 out of the 4 victims had African-American hair found in their underwear or on their bodies that was not a match to their own.
Interesting.
With this evidence, police believed that the murders were carried out by the same person and that the perpetrator was a black male. On November 15, 1971, just a month and a half after the murder of Nina Moshe Yates, 18-year-old Brenda Woodard goes missing. So here's a photo of Brenda.
She's very pretty.
She's very pretty.
How old was she?
She was 18, so she was the oldest, and you can tell.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's stunning. She attended a high school night program and was an aspiring elementary school teacher. That evening, after meeting a classmate for dinner at Ben's Chili Bowl, Brenda and her friend boarded the public transit bus together at approximately 10:25 p.m. However, Brenda had to make another stop and transfer to a different bus, so her and her friend parted ways at that time. When her friend arrived at his stop, he used a payphone to call Brenda's apartment to make sure she got home safely. However, he was told by her roommate that she had not yet arrived to the apartment. At 11:30 p.m., Brenda's roommate called her parents, worried that she had not yet made it home. Less than 6 hours later, Brenda's body was found on the access ramp for the Baltimore-Washington Parkway. Brenda's mother, who was on the way to work just after the body had been found, noticed the commotion and also saw a wig on the side of the road. She immediately felt as though the wig looked just like Brenda's. So here's a photo of the wig sitting sort of on the median grassy area in between the road.
That is a very eerie picture.
Yep, it is.
Very unsettling.
Mm-hmm. So obviously this wig was very distinct, and as soon as her mother saw it, she just got a bad feeling.
Yeah.
She essentially said to her husband, I feel like that was her wig.
Mm-hmm.
And her husband was like, relax, like, let's check in with police, blah, blah, blah. But when she did check in with police, they had found the body, and she had seen the commotion that morning, and it was Brenda's body. She showed them her photograph, and they were able to figure out that it was her.
Wow.
Brenda had been strangled and sexually assaulted. However, unlike the previous victim, she had also been stabbed. The cause of death was a stab wound to the right side of her chest. She had been redressed and her clothes were carelessly put back on, and she was wearing her shoes. This time, a velvet coat had been draped over Brenda's body, and detectives found a handwritten note inside her coat pocket. The note read, quote, "This is tantamount to my insensitivity to people, especially women. I will admit the others when you catch me if you can. Freeway Phantom." So here's a photo of the note. So a couple things that are interesting here is that the perpetrator used the word tantamount.
I was
going
to say.
Which is just a weird-ass word.
That's a very, yeah.
And
I don't think I've ever heard that word used before.
Yeah, and then insensitivity is spelled wrong. It says insensitivity, like T-I is written twice.
It's clearly a man's writing.
I felt it looked like a man's writing, too.
Yeah, the chicken scratch.
Yeah.
And
it's just a mixture of lower and uppercase letters as well, which is strange.
Yeah. And he's signing it Freeway Phantom. So he's clearly following this in the media.
Mm-hmm.
This is now like the second or third thing that he's leaving behind as like a clue for police. He's enjoying this whole game that he's playing.
Yeah, he's totally getting off on it.
Calling the families and breathing into the phones and then like just chucking shoes from other girls beside bodies, and now he's leaving notes and shit. He obviously wants to get caught, but he knows that he's not gonna get caught because right. He's gotten away with it for this long.
So the note, which like you said was clearly meant to taunt the police in their investigation, ramped up the media. So essentially a frenzy began, and it also ramped up the fear that was felt by young Black girls in the area. The senator of Maryland released a statement offering sympathy to the families and begging the public to come forward with information to help them catch the perpetrator, who had at this point murdered 5 young girls. He also told residents to be cautious and take extra steps to protect themselves and their children. Parents began escorting their children whenever they had to leave their homes, which is what I would do. My kid would not be out of my sight.
Absolutely not.
Ever. Large amounts of phone calls were made to suggest to police potential suspects or suspicious circumstances. Sergeant Romain Jenkins said, quote, "We were looking at priests, police officers, doctors. Every male that you could think of ended up being a suspect at the time," end quote. Investigators even at one point created a life-size mannequin replica of Brenda wearing her clothes and took a photo of it and released it to the newspapers in hopes that witnesses who saw her walking or who may have seen something would have come forward. Because of the overwhelming number of suspects without any convincing evidence or leads, detectives made an attempt to reduce the list by further analyzing the handwritten note that had been found in the jacket that was placed over Brenda Woodard's body. Investigators found that the note was written on paper that had been cut from Brenda's school notebook, and after analyzing the handwriting, also realized that the note had not been written by the perpetrator, but by Brenda.
Oh.
Yeah. it was going from upper to lowercase, which was strange. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Brenda wrote like that or if she just wrote like that in the note.
Yeah.
But what was even more compelling was that when they analyzed her handwriting, it didn't show any signs of panic or distress. So there were no areas in her writing that indicated she was shaking or trembling.
Yeah.
Which is very strange as well.
Right.
So with this, Detective Jenkins theorized that Brenda might not have felt as though she was in danger when she wrote the note, and that she potentially might have known her abductor and eventual murderer, and he dictated what he wanted her to write.
Well, it was kind of the same with that other girl who was calling her parents on the phone saying that what she was in a cab with a white man.
Saying she was in a house with a white man and he was going to send her home in a cab.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But she didn't sound like she was in distress at the
she
time.
She was crying.
Okay.
But she wasn't yelling or anything, but she was clearly upset.
Yeah.
But she was sort of whimpering and crying silently.
Yeah.
It was also initially thought at this point that the perpetrator was targeting young girls with the middle name Denise because three of the girls had the middle name Denise.
Hmm.
So the media sort of became preoccupied with this idea, but this was a fairly common name at the time, so it was eventually chalked up to an unlikely coincidence.
Yeah.
But people were so terrified that at one of the girls' funerals, when people came in and signed the book, people were terrified that the ones that were either named Denise or had middle names Denise would be next.
Yeah, that is a very scary thought.
Yeah. Just before the freeway phantom would strike again, the Watergate break-in occurred. So at the time, President Richard Nixon was running for re-election. And as I said before, the United States were involved in the Vietnam War, which created a division within politics in the country. In May of 1972, members of Robert Nixon's committee to re-elect broke into the Democratic Committee's Watergate headquarters, which is located in Washington, D.C. They essentially stole copies of private documents and they bugged the phones. And because the Watergate scandal was investigated by the FBI, this ultimately led to the removal of investigators and resources from the Freeway Phantom case. How much of that did I understand? Not very much. I'm just not a political person.
No.
But if you are, hopefully that made some sense. People broke in and did some bad shit.
Yeah. I've heard of Watergate, but I've never actually looked into
it. Yeah, I didn't know exactly what it was.
Yeah.
And if you want to criticize me for my lack of politics knowledge, please feel free. I don't watch the news.
Criticize me as well.
Yes. I don't read that shit.
Yeah.
So yeah, this was bad, obviously, in many ways, but also because the FBI investigated it. So I think it was like half of the team had to go off of the Freeway Phantom case to investigate the Watergate scandal.
Yeah, it was huge.
Yeah. I also wasn't alive at this point, so, you know, give me a break. Give us a break.
Yeah, yeah.
A description of the Freeway Phantom was released to the public, and he was described as a man who often invited children into his home and likely lived by himself. The public was urged to report any, quote, sexual deviates or child molesters, end quote. Information from the general public was provided through a hotline that was set up by the Metropolitan Police Department of the District of Columbia, or the MPDC, as well as through letters sent into the police stations. Within the first 7 hours of opening the hotline, upwards of 500 phone calls were made. Some believe that the Freeway Phantom himself called tips into the hotline in order to lead police in a different direction, which obviously would not be shocking.
Mm-hmm.
Although many leads provided by the public could be quickly ruled out, some leads needed considerable investigation, which used both time and manpower and womanpower. The investigation was carried out by many organizations. The MPDC Homicide and Sex Squad, detectives from Prince George's County and Montgomery County, Maryland, the Maryland State Police, as well as the FBI. Although there was not much information provided to the public in regards to the details of the case or investigators' progress, at this time, the public knew that detectives were not confident by any means that they would soon find the man responsible for these murders. Despite warnings from police, a vigilante group was formed, which was made up of war veterans who separated into groups and patrolled the following areas 24 hours a day: the Baltimore-Washington Parkway, the Capitol Beltway, and the George Washington Memorial Parkway. which I think is sick.
Mm.
Like, good for you guys.
Yeah.
24 hours a day, and in the times where they felt something might happen, they sent extra guys in.
That's how things should be handled.
And it could have, I mean, these weren't police officers, but this could have prevented him from striking.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm all for the vigilante life.
Yep.
Sign me up.
Mm-hmm. After the murder of Brenda Woodard, it was clear that the killer was escalating. However, another young girl would not go missing until approximately 10 months later. So this was a serious cooling off period,
mm-hmm.
where no girls went missing.
Yeah.
And could it have something to do with the group? It could have.
It's quite the change of frequency that he's doing this.
Yes.
From going, what, a week
mm-hmm.
to a couple months between killings and suddenly going 10 months?
Yep.
Yeah, I would say that it probably has a lot to do with the fear of him being caught.
Yep. I also thought, could he have been in the military and been away? Or could he have been in prison? Or, you know, you just sort of think, could he have been somewhere else?
Yeah, I was kind of thinking, too, with this whole Vietnam thing, like, had the troops already been sent to war at this point?
Oh, God, don't ask me war questions either.
I'm pretty sure they would have been.
I would assume
been.
So, yeah. Yes. The U.S. was involved before that, so I would say it's not unlikely to think that maybe troops were being sent back and forth.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say that the thing that crossed my mind sort of at the beginning of this episode when you were talking about like how this all happened during the time of like the Vietnam War and stuff was if this perpetrator is potentially a veteran mm-hmm. or has served in the war.
Yep.
And he's home now and I don't know a lot about the Vietnam War, but I know it was pretty fucked up.
Yeah.
And like some of those soldiers, what they saw and had to deal with, it mentally fucks you up. Not just in the Vietnam War, in any war.
Yeah.
But, you know, for him to come back home and have this time when he's sort of just sitting around and he might be somebody who's just filled with all this rage
mm-hmm.
and he's looking to take it out on vulnerable people. Because a lot of psychopaths actually get into the army so that they can kill people legally,
yeah,
basically.
That's not shocking.
So, I mean, who knows, right? But yeah. That's just something that kind of crossed my mind. I guess we'll never know because it's not solved yet. So,
mm-hmm. I mean, hopefully we do, but yeah.
Yeah.
You could ask me about politics and you could ask me about history and I will tell you zero.
Yeah. Yeah. I know a little bit about politics now. But nothing like pre-Trump, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the only thing that got me watching.
Mm-hmm. And not
because we want to. It's hard to look away. It's like a train wreck, right?
Yes. So, like I said before, this was 10 months after the fifth victim was murdered. On the evening of September 5th, 1972, 17-year-old Diane Williams, a high school student and aspiring model, headed to her boyfriend's house after cooking dinner for her family. She was the eldest sibling and often took care of her younger siblings while her parents were at work. So I'm going to show you a photo of Diane.
They're all just so pretty.
They're all beautiful, and it's just heartbreaking to look at these photos
mm-hmm.
and think of how they lost their lives and how their families are just sitting and waiting to know who did it.
Unimaginable.
Diane had a curfew, and her boyfriend walked her to her bus stop near his family home. He waited with her until the bus arrived and watched her board. This was the last time she was seen alive, as Diane did not make it home that evening. Approximately 3 hours later, in the early morning of the next day, Diane Williams' body was found alongside the I-295, only 8 feet from the shoulder of the road. Diane was found clothed and wearing her shoes with her name Diane written on the bottoms. However, the shoelaces were missing. She had been strangled, but there were no obvious signs of a sexual assault other than traces of semen that were assumed to be from her boyfriend that they found in her clothing. However, Diane's boyfriend insisted that they had not been intimate that evening, so the semen could have belonged to the perpetrator. Immediately, police believed that Diane was the sixth victim of the Freeway Phantom due to the way in which her body was dumped by the perpetrator and the fact that she had been strangled to death. Following Diane's murder, her family also began to receive suspicious phone calls wherein a man would call repeatedly into the early hours of the night sometimes saying, quote, "I killed your daughter." Other calls were made where the person on the other line would ask to speak with Diane. Still investigating the case, the FBI reanalyzed the clothing of all six girls, looking for any evidence that they may have missed. Upon comparing the findings, they realized that there were distinct green synthetic fibers found on 5 out of 6 of the girls' clothing. The fibers weren't found on Darlenia Johnson's clothing. However, this was the victim whose body was in an advanced state of decomposition, so that may have been why.
Mm-hmm.
Detectives believed these fibers may have come from potentially, you know, like a shag carpet or the carpet of a vehicle, the interior of a vehicle.
Mm.
Additionally, semen samples were taken from the majority of the victims' bodies. However, as previously stated, DNA testing was not a resource that was available at this time. The perpetrator was clearly specifically targeting young black females whose ages ranged from 10 to 18. All of the girls lived in either the Congress Heights or Anacostia areas of Northeast DC. All of them came from middle-class families. Additionally, at the time they went missing, each girl was last seen walking alone down a main road. 3 out of the 6 girls were found missing their shoes. All of the girls had either been sexually assaulted or had signs of being sexually assaulted and were strangled. However, Brenda Woodard had also been stabbed by the perpetrator. Their bodies were also dumped very close to one another. So I'll show you this map. So that's where all the bodies were dumped. And then I will show you this one again, just with the photos with the I-295 beltway in the center. Just to give you perspective, in this photo, these two girls' bodies were found 15 feet away.
Okay.
Right? So this is close.
So that's like the distance. They have that all mm-hmm. mapped out there?
Yeah. They were very close.
Okay. Wow.
Following the death of the sixth victim, a lieutenant pleaded with the public to come forward with any information. He said, quote, "This man has confided in a close relative or friend. We're seeking this person to come forward to save an eighth victim's life. This man is a bona fide freak. He is mentally unbalanced," end quote. So did you notice that he said eighth victim?
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, I've only discussed 6 victims of the Freeway Phantom, but that's because there was a murder that occurred that was initially linked to the Freeway Phantom, but was eventually found to be committed by someone else.
Okay.
So at that point, they thought he had killed 7 people, but the murder that occurred within that time frame was found to be committed by someone else. So this victim was 14-year-old Angela Barnes, who had also lived in the vicinity. She had been found raped and murdered, but she was shot in the head. So I couldn't find a photo of Angela, but if I do find one, we'll post it on our Instagram. So like I said, she was shot in the head, which is not part of the MO of the Freeway Phantom.
Mm-hmm.
They initially linked it to the Freeway Phantom. However, the most shocking aspect of this murder is that her rapists and murderers, more than one, were eventually caught and convicted, and they were former police officers.
Oh, wow.
So prior to this, these men, named Edward Sullivan and Tommy Simmons, had previously worked as officers for not even 1 year, so they hadn't even completed their probationary period before they resigned, quote, resigned, due to an incident where their guns went, quote, missing. When the men were convicted of the rape and murder of Angela Barnes, detectives were hopeful that they had also found the Freeway Phantom. However, the two men were never successfully connected to the murders. So now I'm going to talk about a potential 7th victim. There is another murder that occurred, and whether it's linked to the Freeway Phantom case remains controversial. So the last murder that I talked about, Angela Barnes, that's not considered a victim of the Freeway Phantom anymore, but it was at the time. So at this point, the Freeway Phantom has 6 known victims. But on November 26, 1972, 18-year-old Tierra Bryant was walking home from a hospital in North Brentwood, Maryland, just outside of the District of Columbia. So here's a photo of Tierra. And she had just called her brother at 5:30 p.m. to tell him that she'd be taking the bus home and didn't need to be picked up. Despite having told her brother this and her mother providing her with bus money, that evening between 6 and 6:30 p.m., a witness saw Tierra walking along Route 1, heading towards her family home. One day later, Tierra Bryant's body is found in the Anacostia River, about 2 miles from St. Elizabeth's Hospital. Tierra was a single mother to her 18-month-old son, Anthony, and she had just returned to school in an attempt to get a better job and provide her son with a good life.
If these are different people committing these crimes and it's not the freeway phantom, the fact that there's this many people just out there killing young Black girls at the same time in the same area is beyond me.
I can't even imagine it at all.
No.
So to think about the fact that they were essentially just going missing every couple months, it's unbelievable.
It is so scary.
Diane, the Freeway Phantom's last quote known victim, went missing in September, and this is the end of November. And another young Black female is murdered.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
To even think now, to have somebody go missing is horrifying. So to think that every couple months somebody goes missing, you would be horrified to leave your home.
I can't imagine it.
And between the ages of 10 and 18, it's like nobody is safe.
Yeah. And why isn't this being blown up in the news?
Mm-hmm.
That children are going missing and being viciously murdered and just thrown onto the side of the road like a piece of trash.
Yeah. We'll get into a little bit of a discussion about how their race played a part. And it totally did.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were Black females and they were forgotten about.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely heartbreaking.
It's disgusting.
So the FBI considers Tierra Bryant's murder a part of the Freeway Phantom killings, but the Washington MPD and Prince George's County do not. Both of these jurisdictions claim that the circumstances surrounding her murder did not fit the MO of the Freeway Phantom. So they stated the perpetrator that did this likely didn't want her body to be found because it was thrown in the river. This was not an MO of the Freeway Phantom. He left his victims out in the open in the grass along a very major roadway so that they would be found.
Mm-hmm.
That was their argument. So when she was found, she was clothed. She was only wearing one shoe, but the other shoe was found nearby. She had also been strangled to death, and there was evidence that she was also sexually assaulted. They didn't find any of those weird green synthetic fibers on her body, but like I said before, she was thrown into the river, so this could have easily washed away.
Right.
So now I'm going to show you a map. So this map shows where they lived, where they were last seen, and where their bodies were found. I really like this map because it's numbered based on the victims, and there's different shapes to show home, where they went missing, and where they were found. And definitely take a minute to look at this, you guys, because it's really, really interesting to see the commonalities between where they lived, where they were picked up, and where their bodies were found. In the photo, you can also see the I-295 Beltway. You can see the White House, and it really shows how close it all happened.
Mm. Yeah, they're not found far from their last sighting at all.
Right. So in some of the cases, the girls were kept for days. In one of the cases, it was literally just over half an hour, and she had been raped, murdered, and dumped.
Yeah, that's crazy. Like, what would make him want to keep certain girls over others, or just immediately kill this girl and dump her?
It also seemed that he kept his first victims, if they were his actual first victims, he kept those victims for longer. And maybe he just felt it was getting too risky.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe he was just escalating to the point where he just felt he needed to kill and that was it.
Yeah.
Investigators believed that the Phantom's motivation was a profound hatred and anger towards women, and that he may have felt that he was mistreated by society in general. It was thought that he was a psychopath who may have been choosing his victims due to a connection with a woman in his life or from his past, like an ex-girlfriend or mother. It was presumed that he lived in the area of Washington, D.C. It was clear that he owned a vehicle which he used to abduct, transport, and dispose of his victims' bodies, and he also may have brought the victims to abandoned homes where he would carry out the rapes and murders. Following the murder of 17-year-old Diane Williams, so this would be the sixth victim, investigators began looking into other cases, specifically cases with convicts who had been involved in abductions and rapes in an attempt to identify the Freeway Phantom. This led them to Robert Askins, an ex-convict who had a lengthy history involving abductions, rapes, and murders. First of all, I was just horrified to think about the fact that this guy was not still in prison, but I'll get into that. This man's criminal history showed that he had a profound hate for women. At 19 years old, he poisoned 5 sex workers using cyanide, killing one of the women, 31-year-old Ruth McDonald. Only a couple of days later, he stabbed and killed another sex worker, 26-year-old Elizabeth Johnson. During his trial, it was found that Robert Askins had actually been working as a police informant, helping investigators arrest sex workers. When he was arrested, he told police that he was a, quote, woman hater. After a period of mental observation, it was determined that Askins was criminally insane, and he was institutionalized at St. Elizabeth's Hospital. And while in hospital, he escaped from his restraints and assaulted 3 staff members using a chair. He was placed in this institution for 12 years, and just 5 months following his release in 1952, he killed again. He strangled another woman, 42-year-old Laura Cook, to death. He was indicted for her murder in 1954 and was also retried for the first murder of Ruth McDonald, wherein it was determined that he was not insane at the time of the murder, and he was convicted and sentenced to 20 years to life. However, his conviction was overturned 4 years later. In 1978, Robert Askins was charged with abducting and raping a 24-year-old woman. Again.
Like, how is this? Yeah, like you said,
like,
how
is
this?
What is happening?
Yeah.
He's just insane. Let's just put him in a hospital for a few years and release him.
Yeah.
And then he kills again. And then his conviction gets overturned. And then he rapes and abducts somebody else. I don't understand how that happened.
Yeah.
So in 1978, he was charged with this abduction and rape. And that's when the police looked at his file and they were like, what is going on? This guy has an extensive history of killing women, poisoning them and strangling them.
Yeah.
There were 2 aspects of his MO that investigators felt were similar to the Freeway Phantom. In one of his cases, he attempted to get the victim to tell police that she was in Maryland, which was comparable to what Brenda Crockett had said over the phone to her father, kind of lying, saying she was somewhere else. And he also had a victim write a note to taunt investigators, which could be compared to the one that was left on Brenda Woodard's body.
Mm-hmm.
Upon speaking with individuals who were associated with Robert, investigators found that Robert frequently used the word tantamount.
Interesting.
And that was found in the note, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a word. I don't know if it was like that in the 70s, but I've literally never used that word in my life.
Definitely not a common one.
Detectives believed at this point that they may have found the Freeway Phantom. So they issued a search warrant and police specifically looked for carpet that might match the fibers found on the girls' bodies. They looked for hair as well as any souvenirs kept from victims. While they did find earrings, buttons from women's clothing, and a knife, nothing was found to indicate the source of the green fibers, nor were they able to make a connection between Askins' hair and any of the hair that was found on the girls' bodies. Additionally, Askins' known victims were between the ages of 24 and 42, so this also didn't fit the MO of the Freeway Phantom, whose victims were much younger.
Mm-hmm.
So he was ruled out as a suspect.
And when was his, like, killing spree? From the beginning when he was, like, 19 or whatever to...
It was in the 50s that he killed women.
Okay.
And then he raped and abducted a woman in the late 70s when he got out of prison after his conviction was overturned.
And was he, like, still in prison while the Freeway Phantom stuff, he was out at that point?
He was out. So it's completely possible that it was him.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people who still think it was.
Right.
So he died, good riddance, in a correctional facility in Maryland in 2010 at the age of 91. He denied being responsible for the Freeway Phantom murders and even said that he didn't have the, quote, depravity of mind required to commit any of the crimes, end quote, which, like, come up with something better.
Right.
You poisoned and murdered multiple women.
Yeah.
So what are you talking about?
Right. Although I would think that somebody who is capable of taunting the police the way the Freeway Phantom did would continue to do that in prison. Like, if it mm-hmm. was this guy who was responsible, I feel like there would be some element of that, dropping hints or wanting to, like, drag things out or saying, you know, like, oh, I'll give you, like, another murder, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that that didn't happen makes me question if it was him.
Right. And, you know, they didn't find anything.
Yeah.
And if they found other sort of souvenirs or women's items, there was no green fibers. I think most people say, you know, probably wasn't him, but there are some people who still think he was the most likely suspect.
I wonder with, like, DNA testing now, if they would have, like, kept a piece of his hair or whatever
mm-hmm.
and kept the hair from the victims, if they're able to match those now.
We'll get into the DNA stuff.
Okay.
It gets worse, Kristen. It gets worse.
Okay.
So before we get into that, I'm going to talk about another possible suspect or suspects. So in 1974, a group of suspects were investigated. A jailhouse informant found in Lorton Prison in Virginia called a homicide investigator and indicated that a man named Morris Warren, who was an inmate at the prison, not only had information on the Freeway Phantom case, but that he knew who had abducted and killed the young girls. When he was initially spoken to by investigators, Morris Warren denied having any information about the Freeway Phantom case, but he did eventually end up providing detectives with information that seemed quite promising in their investigation. During the time period that the Freeway Phantom was active, there was also a series of abductions and rapes happening, wherein women would be grabbed off the street by suspects driving a green Vega. Do you know this kind of car?
No.
I'll show you a picture because I didn't either. It's a Chevy Vega. It's kind of what I picture when I think of cars in the 60s and 70s, yeah, to be
honest.
Yeah,
just like an old muscle car.
Mm-hmm. At this time, many of the perpetrators involved had already been arrested and were awaiting indictment on the rapes, and Morris Warren was one of them. Morris indicated to investigators that the rapes and murders committed by the Freeway Phantom were actually done by members of the Green Vega gang. He indicated that he would only provide information if his identity would remain anonymous, and also stated that he was not involved in the homicides, providing detectives with a credible alibi. Warren identified the man who had given him the information about the crime, the place and time that the crime occurred, as well as accurate and specific details which were thought to not have been provided to the public by the media. He told detectives that if he provided this information, he also wanted to make a deal where he would be released from prison and would receive part of what was a $10,000 reward in the Freeway Phantom case. Thinking they were onto something, the FBI decided to take Morris Warren on two separate ride-alongs in order to determine if the information he was providing was credible. During the first ride-along, Morris led investigators to the dump sites of Brenda Woodard and Darlenia Johnson. The locations provided by Morris were accurate, however, there were discrepancies in the descriptions of the crimes. There were certain pieces of information that Morris Warren had difficulty keeping straight, such as mixing up details involving the two cases as well as aspects of the crime scenes. As investigators began to question Morris Warren's credibility and intentions, during the second ride-along, a story regarding the Freeway Phantom came on the radio, wherein the reporter indicated that the Prince George's state's attorney was closing in on the Freeway Phantom's identity due to help from a cooperating inmate from Lorton Penitentiary. This made Morris Warren extremely upset. He worried that inmates were going to realize that it was him, so he outright refused to cooperate further with investigators. After detectives attempt to sway Morris to continue to provide information, they realize that he is in fact not a credible source. The green Vega that was alleged by Warren to have been used by the perpetrators to abduct and kill all six girls hadn't actually been manufactured until after the spring of 1972, when most of the victims of the Freeway Phantom had already been found. One DC homicide investigator was sure that the Green Vega gang were responsible because Morris Warren took the police to the scene and described how the girls were killed and provided other details. And this detective actually retired believing that these men were responsible. So he said, quote, "How can a man tell you about a crime, the scene, clothing the girls wore, how she was killed if he wasn't there?" End quote. However, it had been determined that this was not true because it was realized that the information provided to police did come from news reports. Morris Warren also made no mention of the note found on Brenda's body, and none of the hair samples taken from the Green Vega gang were consistent with the hairs found on the victims. On top of this, FBI detectives came across letters that had been sent between Green Vega gang members, wherein Morris said that he had lied to the police to try to get out of prison.
Makes sense.
Yep. So he essentially wasted months of investigators' time before they moved on and cleared them as suspects.
Mm-hmm.
Time was not on the investigators' sides. They had no viable leads in the case, and as newer rape, murder, and abduction cases came forward, they began to focus less and less on the Freeway Phantom case. After 1972, the abductions and murders came to a halt, and it seemed the investigation did as well. So after this, it stopped.
Just nothing else after
nothing.
That?
Nothing. Carol Spink's sister, Evander Spink's Belt, said, quote, "In the aspect of my sister's death, once a month I would stop by the police station. I did it for years, just trying to find out what's going on, what's going to happen next. But the police would brush me off because nobody wanted to talk about it, which I never understood why. I don't know if they all gave up, but I felt as though 90% of them gave up." End quote.
Well, yeah, because there's nothing else happening. So
right.
It's really sad that they didn't have the drive to want to go back and continue looking into the and like solving these murders. But I can't really say that I'm shocked by that.
Yeah, no. As time passed and the Freeway Phantom murders grew more distant, the identity of the Freeway Phantom remained unknown. And whether he was deceased, alive, in prison, or walking the streets of DC also remained a mystery. The young girls were forgotten and the investigation slowed more and more with each passing year. However, in 1987, Detective Romaine Jenkins had been promoted to sergeant and was now in a position within the force where she could bring more awareness back to the Freeway Phantom case. In regards to this, she said, quote, "Someone had to speak for the children, and that's what I felt my job was," end quote. This is where the investigation of the Freeway Phantom takes a horrible turn. As the reinvestigation began and Jenkins attempted to take another look at the evidence, she found the words, quote, "evidence destroyed," with dates indicated within the property book. She came to find that everything was destroyed, down to each single piece of evidence and the extensive case files. There was absolutely no evidence remaining.
Why?
Yeah, that's what I wondered.
A police officer did this, obviously?
Yeah, so there are procedures and guidelines involved in destroying evidence, and one of the guidelines states that the case must not be open in order to destroy the evidence. However, obviously the case was still open,
mm-hmm.
But it's alleged that because these cases had essentially been abandoned and forgotten, many believed that they had been closed, so that's why the evidence was destroyed. Some family members of the deceased girls believe that the evidence was disposed of because the girls did not matter to investigators and police. But my question is, why would evidence in rape and murder cases even be thrown out in the first place, regardless of if the case is open or closed?
Right. And even if, you know, it went quiet and people just, you know, whoever thought like, oh yeah, like, you know, there's nothing on this, I'll just throw this out. Wouldn't it be protocol to like make sure it's a closed case before mm-hmm. you just go throwing things out? That doesn't make any sense to me. It's super fucking shady. And I feel like there's definitely a reason behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody is trying to like cover something up.
Yeah. When I heard this, I sort of thought about the police officers that were charged in the other murder.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sort of makes you think, was there somebody somewhere covering up for someone? Because it just seems like such a major mess up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how does that happen? And I know we're in a different time period, but how does somebody go in and destroy all of the case files and all of the evidence from a case?
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense to me.
From probably one of the biggest cases in the state at the time. Mm-hmm.
But for them, I think the point that the families were trying to make was that it wasn't big because they were forgotten about and they were Black girls and they didn't care.
Yeah, fair enough.
It's really, really, really heartbreaking. And obviously Sergeant Jenkins was heartbroken and she had no evidence to re-examine. So because of this, she was still determined and she contacted the FBI in an attempt to reestablish the files. Thankfully, she came across file cabinets which contained folders and files that had been preserved by the FBI and was able to recover the coroner's reports from the murders. Obviously, these were beneficial, but a lot more information was needed, so she decided to speak to the detectives that initially carried out the investigation. Many of them actually provided her with their original notebooks that they kept, and all of the detectives were helpful and provided any information that was needed. Due to the fact that these original detectives investigated the case and visited the crime scenes, she was able to recover a decent amount of information. A behavioral analysis of the Freeway Phantom was then built based on this information. It was believed that the perpetrator kept to himself, demonstrated psychopathy, and as stated before, hated women. What was added to this was that he likely worked for a living and was between the ages of 27 and 32 when the murders were carried out. It remained a possibility that the man knew some of the victims and they either trusted him or he was able to earn their trust in some way. Through further analysis of the dump sites, investigators also theorized areas that the perpetrator may have lived, worked, or that were of importance to him. This helped detectives map out important areas to begin investigating suspects. Although investigators worked hard, there was no arrest made in the Freeway Phantom case, and Sergeant Jenkins retired in 1994. With no forensic evidence to analyze, it was extremely difficult to piece the case together. In regards to the evidence, Brenda Crockett's sister said, quote, "I never felt that the police were on my side about my sister's murder. I think they could have done more. I think they could have maintained the evidence. We have more technology now than ever. And you can go back and pull just a little hair and get DNA evidence. And they don't have any? It's sad." End quote. Sergeant Jenkins said, quote, "I feel so sorry for the families. The cases should not have been purged because they were never closed. And because they were the first really serial cases in the District of Columbia, those files should have been maintained. I just hope that these cases will be memorialized, and we learn from the mistakes that were made, and the public should always be aware because it could very well happen again." End quote.
I can't imagine the feeling as a parent or a family member having your child go missing and then later finding out that they were killed. That feeling, but then leaving it in the hands of the police to solve, knowing that they very well may not solve it, like that alone is a very helpless feeling.
Absolutely.
Especially when you as a normal citizen can't do anything to assist them.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to let them solve it.
Yeah.
I don't think I would be able to sleep, but then having the evidence just completely burned up in flames.
What?
I have no words to describe how fucking enraged I would be.
Yep.
Like, you guys were supposed to solve my child's murder and the murders of these five other girls, and you couldn't do that, and you let this guy just continue go on killing people, and then you just threw out the evidence not only for my child's murder, but five other plus murders as well. Like, how does that happen?
It really doesn't make any sense.
It definitely sounds like a cover-up.
It's suspicious, for sure.
Like, the evidence doesn't get thrown out on open cases unless there's something suspicious going on.
Like, this was a big decision for a person to make and a lot of evidence to throw out.
Yeah.
So someone was actively destroying and getting rid of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew what they were doing. To me, it just does not make any sense.
Absolutely.
So thankfully, after the Freeway Phantom case and the destruction of the evidence, the city council established better laws for the retention of evidence in criminal investigations by establishing that any and all evidence in unsolved homicide cases should be held for at least 65 years.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
And that's how it should be, because that you're able to solve old cases with keeping evidence.
Mm-hmm. But it's not even like, you know, maybe I might be able to think, okay, it was 60 years old. It was like 10 years old.
Yeah.
It was like 15 years old.
Yeah.
What is happening?
Right.
Some believe that an important clue into the identity of the Freeway Phantom was that he may have used St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C. as an anchor point, implying that the perpetrator may have been familiar with the building, perhaps as a former patient, a doctor, or an employee. Another probable clue is that the Freeway Phantom seemed to keep trophies or souvenirs of his victims, such as textbooks, curlers, shoes, and shoelaces. So investigators are still hopeful that someone might stumble upon one of these souvenirs and ultimately the killer's identity. So like a family member at the home or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, due to the fact that the Freeway Phantom's murders stopped cold in 1972, it's believed that at this point he was either incarcerated, moved away from the area, or died. In regards to the perpetrator, Detective Jenkins said, quote, "In my opinion, the forensics on this show he was a black male. He was in his early to mid-20s. He had been in Vietnam. Why did I say that? When I showed the note to two separate people, one was from the FBI and one was from Naval Investigations, and they both said that note is military," end quote. Many aspects of the Freeway Phantom case made it especially challenging to solve. The most obvious reason would be the loss of evidence. It is alleged that a semen sample taken from Diane Williams' body that had been preserved, so that's because her murder happened in the other jurisdiction,
mm-hmm.
was sent in 2002 for forensic testing. However, there have been no updates in regards to whether the tests were successful or if they generated any results. So in terms of looking up information and articles on this, the most recent I could find was in 2009, just talking about how the sample was sent for testing and nothing has been said about it since.
Mm-hmm. I find stuff like that very interesting because nowadays there's so many of these like ancestry DNA things that you can send in your own little like DNA kits to find out your ancestral history.
Right. Yep.
Like we did that when I was pregnant.
Yeah. So that actually just did that. Did and I'm you? Waiting on my results.
Yeah. It's very interesting and they update it every couple years
because right.
they get more and more people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go on there and literally scroll through like your 53rd cousin.
Right.
Like it goes super far back into your family tree. And more people are doing that. It's like a super popular thing. Like what? There's another one called
23andMe.
Yeah, that one.
Yep.
I think there's another one too. So I think with more of that, I believe that some of the fine print on that is that you are basically signing over your DNA to police if they need it.
Right.
Which I think is how it should be.
Sure, it's amazing. Absolutely.
If you have nothing to hide, then go mm-hmm. ahead. Like use my DNA mm-hmm. if that's going to help solve a crime.
If you're
going to
identify my fourth cousin,
yeah.
you know, killed somebody.
So yeah, I find it interesting with all these cases that are now being solved with these type of DNA websites.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, hopefully they can keep that semen DNA mm-hmm. and like find the cousin, the second, third, fourth, fifth cousin of a potential suspect,
right,
to help them get closer mm-hmm. to justice. But clearly it hasn't happened yet. I'm just hoping that behind the scenes they are still doing everything that they possibly can and using all of this new technology and information to continue running these tests to try to solve it.
Yeah, absolutely. You'd think that if there is a viable sample, that if they ran it in one of these websites, they might come across a hit of some relative
yeah.
of the person.
And regardless of how old the case is or not.
Mm-hmm. And whether the person is dead or not.
Yeah.
These families deserve to know who killed their daughters.
Absolutely. And that just needs to happen for the victims themselves. Like you have to solve these cases and find the killer.
Mm-hmm.
And like, even if this guy was like, let's say in his 30s, when all this was going on back in the 70s.
Yep.
That would make him like 80 years old today.
Mm-hmm. He could very well still be alive.
Yeah. And it baffles me how somebody can go on a killing spree like that and then suddenly just halt everything.
Right.
And go on about their lives. Like, clearly that happens a lot because there's a lot of serial killers who haven't been caught out there,
mm-hmm.
who are in their 70s, 80s, and, you know, their old heydays are in the past. I always wonder that, like, how do you get up every morning and be like, oh yeah, remember like 40 years ago when I used to just like go on these killing sprees and strangle women? Like,
and thank God we live in a time now where these things don't happen as often, nearly as often, because people yes. can't get away with it.
Thank God.
Because you would literally have to be Dexter Morgan to get away with stuff like this.
Literally, yeah.
And, you know, to be in a time where people could go around doing this willy-nilly, and if nobody saw it, you couldn't find who did it.
Yeah.
It's so scary.
Yeah.
It's really, really scary to think of.
Yeah, and back then there wasn't as much surveillance footage as there is today, and, you know.
Yeah, CCTV.
Dash cams mm-hmm. and social media and tracking devices and cell phones. Like, it's pretty easy to track someone's whereabouts, basically, you know, mm-hmm. whenever you want to.
Yep.
And there wasn't any of that back then.
No, they just had to rely on, did you see this person?
Yeah.
And we know that witness accounts are not always accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And people could have just said, oh yeah, actually I did see her. She was abducted by two people in a red car. Like, they could have just said it to try and get their name out there, right? Yeah. You just have no idea.
Yeah.
And I think obviously that adds to a lot to why it was not solved. Another thing is that investigators assume that the man was likely charming and that he wouldn't have stood out as a likely suspect. He could have been educated, could have been married, employed, highly skilled, if he was military, and all of these things would have made him more difficult to identify,
mm-hmm.
and also more easily able to lure his victims.
Yeah.
There were also multiple jurisdictions involved in the investigation, and that could have been a cause for confusion, miscommunication, and as I previously mentioned, the Vietnam War and the Watergate scandal. It just pulled investigators away from the case and attention away from the case, especially in those crucial hours and days after somebody goes missing. If you don't have your full focus, it's going to be even harder to find someone, because if you're relying on witness accounts and help from the public, and it's been 2, 3 weeks, months, I don't even remember what I did 2 days ago.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that made it really difficult.
I know.
Finally, the race of the victims likely also played a part in solving the case. Despite the fact that detectives have worked tirelessly in the Freeway Phantom case, the question of if the case would have been solved if the victims were white became even more prevalent as the public witnessed the investigation of the abduction and murder of two white victims, Catherine and Sheila Leon, in 1975. A case that was highly publicized after the girls were abducted from a shopping mall. Many contrast this case with that of the Freeway Phantom, obviously because it happened around the same time, and because they felt that detectives worked incessantly from 1975 onward to find the girls' killer. Another aspect about this is that the girls' bodies were never found, but the perpetrator was charged after a cold case investigation team took over the case. Detective Tommy Musgrove, who joined Washington's police force in 1972, agreed that victims' race could certainly have been a determining factor in whether or not a case would be solved. Musgrove said, quote, "Those black girls didn't mean anything to anybody. I'm talking about the police department. If those girls had been white, they would have put more manpower on it. There's no doubt about that," end quote. And you think about how when Sergeant Jenkins came back on the case and she pushed and she pushed and she pushed, it should not have taken a black woman to be in charge for somebody to give a shit about these girls.
No.
It really shouldn't. And we don't know everything that the police did. And I know there were a lot of good investigators on this case who worked very, very hard. But the fact of the matter is, it was forgotten about.
Mm-hmm.
And if they were white, we probably would have known way more about this than we do right now.
Absolutely.
It's a very, very sad reality.
Yeah, and just given like the era that this happened in as well, because it, even to this day, when white women go missing, it is extremely highly publicized mm-hmm. in contrast to minorities. Like right. they literally call it the missing white woman syndrome.
Exactly.
It's actually a thing.
Yep.
Like I'm sure everyone's heard about Gabby Petito and
That's
how
exactly
crazy,
who came to my mind.
How crazy that case was. And, you know, there was a lot of buzz in the media for families of, you know, black people, indigenous people who are like, why hasn't my child's case blown up like this?
Right.
And I feel so much for those families because it's so unfair mm-hmm. how society is with that. And it was to the point where her father, Gabby Petito's father, had to come out and make a statement himself and say that, yes, every single missing person should be handled in this exact same fashion.
Right.
And it's true. And this is, that was what, 2021 that happened?
Yes, very recent.
So what, back in the 70s, I'm mm-hmm. sure it was 1,000 times worse.
Yep.
And it is so sad. It's so ridiculous and uncalled for.
Yeah.
Like these are humans. Their cases need to be solved. They have families and loved ones. They're no different than you and I. Mm-hmm. And the fact that their stories are just swept under the rug like that is absolutely fucking appalling to me.
It really is. It's truly, truly disgusting. Carol Spink's sister, Evander, told the Washington Post, quote, "You better bet that if these had been white girls, the police would have solved the cases. They didn't care about us. All the cases involving white girls still get publicity, but ours have been forgotten," end quote. Diane Williams' sister said, quote, "I expected the police to solve Diane's murder, but there have been too many things that have come out where law enforcement missed the point. They dropped the ball and they can't go back to recoup. The best chance of solving most cases is within the first 48 hours. We're coming up on the first 48 years. And yes, it's just a travesty." End quote. Although retired Sergeant Romaine Jenkins wholeheartedly believes that the murders of these young African-American girls weren't made a priority, she did also note that the mishandling of the case by D.C. investigators was, quote, "not totally guided by race," end quote. She pointed out that detectives commonly misplaced their case files when a new administration took over and remembers opening a storage closet in the homicide unit and finding, quote, "case files thrown all over the place," end quote. She also said that she had to give credit to detectives because they, quote, "ran down every lead," end quote, saying that the task force investigated hundreds of suspects. Romaine Jenkins was deeply affected by the inability to solve this case, and she feels that the girls will be with her forever. She said, quote, "What happens when people like me and the families are gone? This will be forgotten," end quote.
And sadly, it probably will.
Yep. To this day, no leads within the case have produced sufficient evidence for prosecution of the Freeway Phantom. The case remains open as a cold case in the MPDC Homicide Division. The public, the investigators, and more importantly, the families of the deceased girls still do not know the identity of the Freeway Phantom, a psychopathic serial killer who took the lives of at least 6 young girls who had their entire lives ahead of them. It seems as though the families must now come to the ultimate conclusion that this case may never be solved. Carol Spink's sister said, quote, "I'm praying my sister's murder will be solved. Whether the person is dead or alive, it doesn't matter. I'm going to try to keep bringing it up, and I want people to remember this really happened to all these young girls, and the first one was my sister," end quote. If you have any information regarding these cases, please call Prince George's County Crime Solvers at 866-411-TIPS. That's 866-411-8477. I'm just going to show you a photo of the current reward poster for the Freeway Phantom murders.
Okay, yeah, up to $150,000 reward.
Yep, so it says Metropolitan Police Department. The reward and photo of the 6 victims.
God, I hope that the families can get some closure someday.
I just can't imagine being on my deathbed not knowing who did that to my child.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly parents, especially,
mm-hmm.
may have died already or might be close to dying, and they have to take this to their grave and they will never know.
the empty, hopeless, helpless feeling that you would have for the rest of your life, knowing that you'll never, ever get your child back and the killer is still out there on the loose.
It's just so unfair.
I can't imagine. And I think it's so important that these old unsolved cases still get talked about, because they are forgotten about. And these families are no less important than recent missing people or murder victims' families.
Right.
And especially victims who are minorities, because as we said earlier, sadly, that is just the way it goes in society. Their cases aren't highly publicized. They don't get the attention it deserves. And it is so important just to keep saying their names and telling the story so that more people can become aware and more people start looking out for things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, can you imagine if somebody just, you know, randomly goes into Uncle George's basement and is digging in the corner and suddenly pulls out these shoes and like notebooks and stuff?
Yeah.
How fucking crazy would that be?
Yeah. Awareness is so, so important.
Yeah, it totally, totally is.
In order for things to change, people need to speak up. People need to do things that will make a difference and talk about it. And it shouldn't have to be the families and this one detective that are pushing to find answers.
No, it shouldn't be. And sadly, at this point, it's probably up to the public to solve it.
Right. And I, you know, it's probably extremely overwhelming to think about back in that time period, how many people were raped and murdered and abducted. And it's probably an unbelievable amount. And they have a lot of things on their plate.
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, it's so important that these people are not forgotten about.
Yeah.
So tell your friends this story. Yeah. Tell them about it. No matter where you live, you never know.
It's a crazy story to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
These young girls, what was the youngest one? 10?
10.
Just being abducted, brutalized, raped, strangled. And then literally thrown on the side of the road like a piece of trash, very openly, very casually. Like, this guy clearly was not trying very hard to hide the bodies.
In fact, he wanted them to be found.
Yeah. And then going as far to fucking sit there and call the families and taunt them and letters.
All we can hope is that this man was caught for something else and is rotting in prison. Or rotted in prison until he died. And that's what I would hope as a parent and a family member. But never knowing would just be absolutely the worst form of torture.
Oh, it would eat me alive 24 hours a day until the day I died.
So if you're looking for some more resources on this case, there is a special on Discovery Plus, and it is very, very well done. And the families of the victims and Detective Jenkins speak. The series is called People Magazine Investigates, and it's season 4, episode 4, The Freeway Phantom. There's also a quick video on YouTube. It's a video from A&E, and it's called The Case I Can't Forget, Romaine Jenkins. So you can find that on YouTube. If you're looking for a lengthy, detailed read, there is a book called Tantamount, Pursuit of the Freeway Phantom Serial Killer by Blaine Pardoe and Victoria Hester. They also have a podcast called Tantamount, where in each episode they go over a different detail or aspect of the case. And then the podcast, Black True Crime Podcast, does an episode on the Freeway Phantom murders. And they also talk a bit about Black history and racial tensions and what was going on at the time. And they provide a really, I think, important perspective on the case. So please go give that one a listen too if you're looking for more information. But yeah, other than that, this was a gut-wrenching one, and when it's unsolved, it just makes it a million times worse, just thinking about the fact that this man may have gotten away with this. I mean, he did get away with this. I'm just hoping that he didn't get away with something else and went down for it.
That's the thing. Like, where is he today?
It's really scary to think about.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you have any information regarding the Freeway Phantom murders, please call Prince George's County Crime Solvers at 866-411-TIPS. That's 866-411-8477. So you know what you're doing next case, right?
I do. Yes. Next case, we're going to be talking about Stephen McDaniel.
Okay.
And Amanda doesn't know anything about this one.
I do not. And I was trying to dodge DMs and messages, so I didn't hear anything about it. But the guy looks like a fucking psycho, so.
Yeah, he looks like
Sideshow. And if he was the Bob. One that was murdered, I'm sorry.
No.
I just assumed not.
Yeah, you assumed right. He is the psycho. And Lauren Giddings was his victim. And this took place in Georgia in 2011.
Okay.
Crazy story. There's like a viral video that blew up on the news that I'll be showing you. And then after that, we're going to probably tag team another case.
I think it's time to do another big one. Maybe send out a vote.
Yeah.
To everyone to see what they think that we should do.
Mm-hmm.
We've definitely had quite a few cases stand out that people have asked us.
Yeah.
Just sending us a message like, we want your in-depth coverage on this one.
Yeah.
So we'll have to scour through that and figure out what we're going to do. Yeah. But yeah, so.
Those ones are the big cases. We always need to tag team them because there's so much information. Mm-hmm. And
like I said, we probably could have tag teamed this one, but hopefully I did. A good job.
You did a fantastic job.
Well, thank you.
And it's a crazy, crazy case. I think you gave a lot of really great detail.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, it's just good to bring these cases back to light.
Just, yeah, like you said, say these little girls' names, these African-American girls whose cases and stories just fell to the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
It's so unfortunate and it's so, so sad.
Yeah.
And our hearts really go out to the family of these victims because we can't even begin to imagine.
Absolutely.
For even a second what that would be like.
No.
Thank you, as always, for listening. And we will get this one out to you guys. And the wait will most certainly be shorter.
Mm-hmm.
We appreciate your patience, as always, especially in the fact that Kristen and I both work. And we're mothers and we've got a lot on the go on top of this. And this is just our little side gig.
Yeah. A lot going on behind the scenes. So, I mean, if we had more hours in the day, we would love to just, you know, dedicate all the time to true crime.
Oh, if this was my full-time job, that would be amazing. Well, but
maybe one day, right?
It's the part-time job for now. For and now. We haven't. One of our listeners sent us $20 once, but. And that was so nice of you. Thank you so much.
Shout out to Kayla Kendall.
Kayla, thank you so much.
Because I know you're listening. Yes, we love you.
But yeah, that wasn't our plea for money. Just to show that we do this with
I actually forgot that we had that, to be honest.
It's still sitting there. We'll use it for something important one day, Kayla.
Yeah, totally.
But yeah, we do this because we love it and we really, really appreciate hearing from you guys. So always send us the message. We try our best to get back to you as soon as we can. And we do definitely always get back to all of our DMs sooner rather than later, hopefully. But it usually doesn't take too long.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Thank you so much for listening. And we will see you next time.
See you guys next time.